The lawyer's duty runs to the entity. It is the entity theory that is at work in 112. And the corollary is, without some action, the constituents are not clients. The ABA model rules that parallel this rule helpfully says that just because you represent an entity does not preclude automatically the lawyer from representing one or more of the constituents.
Bill, let me add a footnote right here.
Yes.
Some of the nastiest lawsuits that I've seen, I've not been involved in one like this, where the constituent begins to believe that the lawyer representing the entity is that constituent's lawyer. And that becomes a very sticky wicket in the event of an investigation. There's some litigation. If you want some references to litigation, William Freivogel, I think Bill's got several references to Bill Freivogel's papers in his Bill's paper provided with this course, to look at those cases and see how the lawyer, the constituent, becomes confused as to who represents the constituent.
Yes.
In a matter that becomes, the constituent becomes a target of an investigation.
In the upper right-hand corner of the PowerPoint is a bracket referring to the page of the paper that George just alluded to, where this is discussed in detail with footnotes. And further, Bill Freivogel's citation to his website is on the bibliography of the paper. So, back to the comment. Notice the last phrase that ABA model rules says. In other words, it says, if because you represent the entity, doesn't preclude representing an individual, if that other representation does not constitute a conflict of interest. So therefore, it sets the stage for representing the entity and perhaps one of the or more of the constituents. Simplest example possible, one person wants to form an entity. Pretty simple. The attorney represents the individual, and then after the entity's formed, it's agreed, will represent the entity.
Now, does that mean, Bill, that the attorney is no longer the attorney for the existing client, or can you have both representations?
I think you can have both, and probably most often would.
Okay.
In fact, I'd say it's a given. It would be unusual in this example for there to be a shift from client to entity, because obviously the client's the one who's running the entity. But we're going to talk about other examples later where that's not necessarily the premise. So the conflict paperwork, even in this simple example, George, would be in the engagement letter. What?
Well, an engagement letter would include a transfer or a movement of the representation, scope of the representation for the formation of the business to a separate entity. And it would either include in that engagement letter a statement that once the new entity is formed, and that's a discussion we'll have a little bit later, but once the new entity is formed, that entity becomes a self-sustaining or a whole client in addition to the existing client. So you need to add something either to engagement letter, the existing engagement letter, or a separate engagement letter at the time of the formation of the entity.
Attached to the entities are seven suggested engagement letters, one of which has this kind of language that George just referred to in it. These seven engagement letters are on my forms that I use regularly, and I've added suggested language from the American College of Trust and Estates Council, ACTEC, which has a series of forms in their form book on multi-party representation. And it's in a family context, but it's helpful language and helpful even in a non-family context. I'd refer you to those. All right, so that's pretty simple. At the moment, your engagement letter makes clear, and it's useful, even though it's one client, one entity. Go ahead and lay that out there, because you never know what the facts are. Client could die, the executor could begin questioning your representation, and so on. All right, so let's move to a different example, a little more complex. Four people want to form a business. They approach the lawyer to represent the group in forming the business, and as we've seen from 112, the lawyer represents the entity. What are the options? Well, you represent one of the four and then shift it to the entity after it's formed. Do you represent all four, then shift to the entity later? Do you represent only at the entity both at formation, perhaps even before formation, and then later.
Okay, before, let's talk about this for a second, Bill. The one person, one entity, it works just perfectly as long as it's a type of entity which does not have a set of complex documents attached to it. Now, if you're forming a partnership or an LLC, you negotiate among the four people the various aspects of the operational provisions of the entity, as well as the entrance and exit from the entity. So you want to be cognizant of what type of entity you're forming. In most of the cases that I have ever really been involved in, I usually was either doing a limited partnership or an LLC.